This episode is sponsored by Smart Travel, a new podcast from NerdWallet. You know that one friend who always finds the best travel deals, picks the right cards, and somehow ends up in first class for the price of coach? Smart Travel is like that friend, but in podcast form. They cover all things travel finance, like which travel cards are actually worth having and which are just heavy, shiny metal. Plus, they break down the simple math for deciding when to use your points and when it makes more sense to just swipe your card and save them for later. Travel smarter and spend less with help from NerdWallet. Follow Smart Travel wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a Voyascape podcast. You can find all of our travel podcasts from around the world at voyascape.com.
The island of Socotra has recently become popularized online. I see more and more people citing this island as one of their bucket list trips, and I see more and more people posting their aesthetic videos of their trip to Socotra. And I think it's because it's being shown on Instagram as this aesthetic and quiet place. You can scroll past images of dragon blood trees and white sand beaches without ever seeing the word Yemen, and without any reference to the political reality that is shaping access to the island. But in January 2026, geopolitics broke this illusion of this island being a detached apolitical escape. Foreign tourists found themselves stranded. Flights were canceled, and there was no clear timeline for when they would be able to leave. The reason was not weather or airline logistics. It was rising tensions between Saudi Arabia and the UAE, tied to Yemen's ongoing conflict. What struck me about this wasn't just that tourists were stuck. It was how surprised many people seemed. And I think they were surprised because of the gap between how the island is presented and marketed and the context in which it actually exists. So today, we're unpacking exactly why travel is political. Here to chat with me is one of our favorite returning guests, Joanna Haugen from Rooted Storytelling. And we also have a first-time guest, Davey Sutton. Davey is a multi-Emmy award-winning journalist and a national travel correspondent. This is Curious Tourism, the podcast focused on making travel better for people and the planet. I'm Erin Hines, travel writer and content creator, and I'm joined by my producer, Katie Lohr.
If you enjoy this show, Erin and I would love you to support it. It's really easy to do so. First, you can double check that you're actually subscribed to this show on your favorite podcast app. And second, if you end up loving this episode, please be sure to share it with a friend, a fellow traveler, or somewhere on the internet.
You can also get in touch with us directly on social media or by email. All our contact info is in the show notes. Hi, Joanna. Hi, Davey. Thanks for joining me on Curious Tourism.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
It's great to see you again.
You too. I'm sure I'm not alone in noticing that there are people who choose consciously, maybe unconsciously, to ignore, avoid, or compartmentalize politics when they travel. I think that people sometimes just feel that travel is separate from politics. What are some of the reasons that you think could explain why this perception exists? Davey, let's start with you.
Yeah, I think it all goes back to, if we're talking about American travelers and our passport privilege, because we get to go to so many places without thinking about it. And we were just born into it in our lifetime, right? So it's also why sometimes we see some of the hiccups that American travelers might have when they go to a place without knowing that they needed a visa to get there. And they get stuck at the customs and they are kind of clueless about it. So I think that's initially why there's just a huge separation, is just that our navy blue passport gives us so much privilege to just go to so many places around the world without having to like officially ask or do all this paperwork or even pay extra. And then because of that disconnect, we don't realize all the systems that are in place in the background, that there are like visas that actually happen even for those places. They're called visa on demand or on site or on entry. Or sometimes you might pay $11 to a place and you don't realize like that is a visa. And that all has to do with politics.
Yeah, I find this a lot with people traveling to Europe, at least. I'm not sure about Americans, but Canadians, we have to pay like $10 before we go. And some people don't realize, like, this actually is a visa you're paying for, but they think it's just, like, this, like, admin fee, which I guess it is, but it's also a visa. You're basically asking for permission to go.
Right.
Joanna, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think the way that we have framed travel and tourism in the past is that it's supposed to be this thing that's very pretty and easy and carefree. It's a means of escape. And sometimes that is to explicitly escape politics or the news. And you see this with things like wellness retreats where you're encouraged to unplug and get away from it all. I mean, the language we use even reinforces this idea that travel is a way to not be involved with politics or the greater world. And as Davey said, for some people in the world, that is a lot easier to do because getting to another place is fairly simple. It doesn't require a lot of paperwork. It doesn't require a lot of extra money or effort. But when we don't talk about politics as a primary thing or issue that is part of tourism, it does get pushed to the background. You know, it's not on the homepage. It's not until you are in your planning stages or your booking parts where you are even looking at things like safety or visas or things like that. So we don't talk about politics aligned with tourism. It's not part of the common narrative. It's not the selling point. And it's actually something we very much avoid into the common imagery and messaging that we have in tourism. And so it's no surprise at all that when people think about travel, they're not thinking about it in the same mindset or space as politics or the world at large.
Can I also add that when we do think about it, when you do go to places and think about it, then it becomes very murky and ugly, right? And so to add to what Joanna says, it's like the tourism industry was very intentional with that because you don't want to look beneath the layers, right? You don't want to see who's actually working and how they're treated or what restrictions they might have. Or like if you're in the desert, like how did these people get to the desert to, make our luxury resort, function? So I think just to add an exclamation point to that, I think that's the extended part of the conversation.
Yeah, it can be uncomfortable for tourists to think about and acknowledge the reality of a place. Also, something you sort of motioned to this, Joanna, that I've been thinking about is how destinations, like in the marketing sense, they probably don't benefit a lot in some cases from talking about their politics. And so like there might be intention there to keep politics separate because they want to appear like uncomplicated for visitors. So in that sense, like for tourists, it's also like you're not really being told outright when you're researching a place about the politics, depending on what kind of resources you look at.
Yeah, and what's so interesting about that, Erin, is that there are places that actually, for lack of a better word, they capitalize on their politics as a selling point. So if you look at Germany, for example, you can go visit concentration camps. And that's something that a lot of people do when they travel to Germany. They go to, Dachau and other places that were the site of Nazi atrocities. That was a political act. And that is something that people are going to visit when they go to Germany. To say that tourism is separate from politics is actually a little bit confusing and ironic in that way, because it is the political past, the historical past of the country that is in part attractive to tourists.
Yeah, it's so true. To be honest, like I never even really thought about that, how like when you go to Germany, like that is political. Like I think about it in the context of war, but like war is political. So yeah, we've touched on the structural elements of the travel experience that are in place that do motion to the fact that it's political. But some of these are pretty easy to miss, especially if you have passport privilege. So we're talking like visas, passports themselves, borders. How do you think that these aspects of the travel experience actually reveal power and politics within travel?
Well, Davey pointed out right away the idea of access. Who gets to travel where and with what level of complexity? And access, I think, is probably the first thing that a lot of people are thinking about when they think about this integration of travel and politics or travel as a political act. I would say that you also have discrimination, who is treated in certain ways and why, and that's very much tied up with politics and laws of certain places. There is an issue of safety, who feels safe in certain places and in certain conditions, and comfort, who feels welcome, who is welcome, and to what extent. So, you know, it isn't only the visas, it isn't only the passports, it's the laws of a place and the cultural norms that have been shaped by history of politics that shapes the way people feel and the way they are treated. And all of those things are political.
Yeah, and I think it's descending on us too, with our Western passports. Now this geopolitical collide with travel and tourism, and we've been seeing it being weaponized with our own government, with threats of certain politicians saying if you don't like what the current administration is doing, they might start tracking you and putting you on list. And all of these threats are becoming real. And if you look on social media, some people are mysteriously having things and issues with their passports. And that's all happening internally. But then externally, with what the American government is doing with visas on other countries, there are some retaliatory actions happening with limits of other countries saying that they might restrict access to American passports as well. So this collision has become closer, where first I established that navy blue passport, and I guess you Canadians also have a navy blue passport as well. But there was just power in these, in particular nations that have this. What's happening literally politically is affecting the access. So the quiet part isn't quiet anymore. It's becoming more vivid to people who never saw it before.
You know, I actually experienced this myself. I mean, this just shows the privilege. For one of the first times in my life, when I was intending to go to Egypt and the rules around visas changed 2 months before I was meant to go, they had switched it from visa on arrival to like an advanced visa that you had to apply for in person at a specific embassy at one location within Canada, which basically made it out of reach for me. I didn't have time or resources to travel to the city I needed to travel to and be there for a week to apply for this visa. I don't remember the details, but it was some sort of retaliatory action from Egypt against Canada. I think because our visa process was very complicated and difficult for Egyptians. So it's fair. But in that moment, I was very frustrated because I was like, I thought I was just going to like fly there and show up and be handed a visa like most countries do for Canadians, which like when you think about it is really such an expression of privilege. It's wild. Like, and you can so easily ignore it until it actually impacts you, which it did in this situation.
I have encountered similar things, Erin, and I'm hearing this from other American citizens, people who hold US passports. It's something that I feel has increasingly been taking place for the last 3 years since Israeli and Palestinian genocide started. Actually, before that, Ukraine, Russia invading Ukraine. I was living in Ukraine shortly before that. And American citizens are experiencing various things abroad that they've never experienced before. I've been calling it the subtle death by a thousand cuts because there are things that American citizens, people who are holding US passports, I should say, are experiencing that they've never experienced before, but that other passport holders have encountered for so long. It's made me think very carefully about the way that I travel. And I too have felt great frustration and also so much more empathy, honestly, for people who have had to fill out paperwork, who have had to pay for visas that are denied, who have missed flights that were booked. We talk about, you know, travel is or is not a political act. And I think that so many of us with the blue passport have been able to pretend that it hasn't been or isn't. But I think that the world that we're living in today is making it more and more clear that it is, in fact, very much integrated with politics.
Yeah, I think in the last year especially, I've seen more examples of it, like just in the mainstream news, even coverage of like situations that really, really express this. It's definitely becoming more common. But Joanna, when you and I talked about this just earlier, you mentioned how it's actually much broader and bigger than just visas and passports. Let's talk about that. Could you explain what you mean by that?
Sure. So in 2018, actually, Rick Steves published a book called Travel as a Political Act. And I remember reading this book at that time. And obviously, so much has happened since then. I was looking back at the book recently, and it made me think about the fact that, you know, tourism does not live in a silo. And as a result of it naturally integrating within societal fabric, it does bump up against politics, political decision making, laws, everything from short term rental laws, where Airbnbs are being restricted in communities. Or just a few years ago, there was during the fires in Hawaii, there was a great lack of water for people who were living in Hawaii, who are locals, indigenous people in Hawaii, but the resorts in Hawaii had access to water resources. The golf courses looked great. The pools were full. People were taking showers. That's because of laws. And, you know, Rick Steves in his book talks about how travel as a political act also means, you know, challenging simplistic narratives. It allows people to see what social welfare programs look like in practice. When we take advantage as Americans who travel to Luxembourg, for example, where the public bus is free, that's because of taxes. And we're taking advantage of that as travelers. Often the cost of going to the emergency room or the hospital is significantly less expensive than if they were to go in the United States. Why? That's a political thing that has to do with, you know, public services. We're able to experience things in some places. For example, when Rick Steves wrote this book, he wrote about the fact that people would go to Amsterdam and partake in the cannabis culture. Why? Because it was legal there, but it's not legal in other, it was not legal in other places at the time. There are all these aspects of the things that we're doing, the ways we're getting around, the way we move, the way we perceive places. And a lot of that is shaped by local laws, by local cultural norms that are shaped by politics. So quite frankly, the way any of us experiences a place is very deeply integrated with this idea of politics.
You know, something else I was thinking about that it was kind of like an aha moment for me. I was like, wow, like even the makeup of the people I encounter when I travel is shaped by politics, because I was thinking about how when we were in Sri Lanka in 2024, there were so many Russians. Everyone we met was Russian. And we realized, oh, it's because Russians are trying to escape the war and they have visa-free entry into Sri Lanka and can stay. One of them literally told us, she was like, I can stay here a long time because of the visa laws here for Russians. And that shaped our experience because so much of that trip was hanging out with Russians, which we had never really done before. Like, we'd never found such a concentration in one country. And we noticed that kind of trend in other countries around the world as well.
And if I can extend that even further, I often have this or just kind of like a wow. It's more not an aha. It's more like, wow, how is this able to happen? And it is all with politics when it comes down to it. But when we're allowed to go to places like Vietnam or Japan, and just a generation or two before we were at war with them, how are we allowed to be here? And then my own personal experiences of, I feel welcomed here. I don't feel any tension here, where I know that there are still residual kind of impacts of the interactions with American soldiers on this particular soil. I really saw that when I was in Vietnam, and just how I was surrounded with the cushion of tourism. But, you know, my dad fought in the Vietnam War, right? And then you hear these awful, dreadful stories of these mixed children that were just left because of American soldiers who bred with some of the locals and just abandoned them. There's all of this ugly kind of residual stuff left over from that war. Or we're able to go to Japan, and Japan is having a big resurgence of inviting us over. But we know, like, I remember just like having my jaw dropped when I learned about what the bombs that were dropped there in World War II. So that is the extended part of it. And that clearly is political, because those countries made an agreement that, despite, you know, what happened, we welcome the tourism dollars to their country and their land.
Yeah. Both those countries are such interesting examples. I remember in Vietnam myself, like, being Canadian, obviously, I was able to like disassociate myself a little bit. But I remember thinking to myself, like, oh, I wonder like what it would feel like to be American here, to be in this museum. I remember going to the museum in Ho Chi Minh and seeing Vietnamese people crying and just how horrific it was, like, and fresh still. And I just remember thinking, like, being American here would be such a weird experience. And then in Japan, like, I often notice, because Japan is having such a moment, it's so popular right now. I talk to so many people who go, who know so little about history, like, who don't go to Hiroshima, who don't know, like, the actual history of, like, how the Japanese were involved in the war. I just, it's so interesting to me how people can really just ignore all of it.
So then that's the wars, but even just like current conflict or just disagreement with politics with like China and the US, but then there's so many people, we're still allowed to go to China, like, and we're still allowed to, there's a lot of people I see, you know, that are expatriating there too. And I'm just like, that actually confuses me. Like, that's above my pay grade. I'm like, how are the like citizens able to navigate, which I'm very grateful for, that there's a separation, because of course, like, governments are messy, like all the governments are messy. And that is should not reflect the citizens, because, you know, like, I think there should be a separation with that, because when it comes down to it, the people are that are trying to just do their daily lives and find the most happiness in their lives. Like, even when there's active conflict, that you're still allowed to like present your passport and be like, yay, I want to go come and see the ancient sites, you know. You know, like, that still fascinates me.
You make me think about a very current and real experience I've been having here in Canada. Last summer, I was traveling in the Yukon, which is right next to Alaska. And so a lot of Americans come into Yukon road tripping. So in the campgrounds there, we were meeting a lot of Americans. And for the first time in my life, Americans were apologizing to us, because I could see that they felt viscerally aware of the fact that, especially at that time, there was a lot of tension between Canada and the US. And they were aware of this, and they were aware that it was uncomfortable for them to be surrounded by Canadians in Canada at that time. I just like really noticed this, because it felt very different. Like, I've never experienced that before in my travels, to have like someone visiting my country apologizing to me for something that is happening politically.
Yeah, I went last year to Quebec City, and I almost just wanted to be invisible as an American. And I was with the tourism board, but I did see, like, in the shops, reflections of what our president was saying towards Canada and Canadians' resistance against that. I don't know if it was just a bubble that I was in, because I knew people knew that it wasn't me, that it was coming from a particular group of Americans that is a small minority that probably likely would not be going to the French part of Canada. So I felt, again, insulated, but did really just see that and felt kind of like, oh, I'm sorry that this is happening, especially to our friendly neighbor that's always been an ally.
Mm-hmm. And on the flip side, like I said to people, I'm sorry to you as well. Like, I feel empathy for especially the Americans that didn't vote for this and don't want this. It actually is kind of a beautiful thing, I think, that people can still be in the same space together and feel that empathy for each other in this kind of political moment.
I think that also reflects one of the key tenets that we often talk about in travel, and that's this idea that travel has the capacity to connect people with people. For the most part, as I've traveled around the world, people know that even though I might be a U.S. citizen, I am not holding the atrocities that American politics are causing right now. That is not me. I think that's true, you know, when we travel anywhere, that when we are a person to a person, we're all, for the most part, we're looking to make sure we feel safe, secure, that our kids have access to food and water and shelter, that we feel loved, that we feel like we belong somewhere, that we feel, you know, safe. That's human nature. That's human to human. And I think that really is where travel has the capacity to bridge beyond politics. It's the chance for us to learn from each other and to understand each other on a very one-to-one scale, because I know that no single person is holding the bigness of a single place's politics. And I do think that's another opportunity for travelers to think about how they can use travel as a way to learn from other places, from people, to meet people on a very individual level. Because I think we almost all recognize that I do not represent America, American politics and people from whatever the case might be. And I think that's really important.
Mm-hmm. I actually have a quick question on this because, Davey, you mentioned wanting to feel invisible as an American. And something that's come up for me, and maybe Erin, I just remember since I started traveling in Canadian culture, there was this whole thing of make sure you have a Canadian patch on your bag. People know you're Canadian. And then you'd hear stories about Americans who would travel with Canadian flags on them to like come across as Canadian. And first of all, I want to know your perception of that. And second of all, what you had just mentioned, Joanna, is that not one person represents. But when you are abroad, you kind of are representing that country in some capacity. And there's a level of responsibility that maybe you didn't even ask for when you are visiting a place. So I guess I'm curious first on the pretending to be Canadian front. And then second, I'm curious about how people might be able to navigate that responsibility that they're traveling with.
I have a friend that's been doing that for like 20 years, but she is Canadian. She's Canadian and American, and she just travels with her Canadian one for like 20 years. So the geopolitics of it all is not new. I think what feels different is that it's in our face more vividly, more actively to that point. But I don't know personally of any Americans who don't have a Canadian passport slapping on the maple leaf.
It's a myth. It's a Canadian myth.
I actually kind of think it is because I've never encountered this in the wild. I see talk of it everywhere, but I've never actually encountered it.
Well, especially my friends from the Toronto area, I was like, yeah, they can pretend, you know, like you don't really know the difference until there's an unauthorized sorry inserted. But the accents are pretty, like, you know, ambiguous, and we can be in a group together and then suddenly someone will say sorry and I'm like, why are you apologizing? Like, there's nothing to apologize for. So that's my little joke about Canadians that, you know, sometimes there's not that big of a vivid difference in the wild.
I think, Katie, to your second point about the responsibility as somebody who's abroad and not in their home country. So I am a U.S. citizen. I've not lived on American soil for a decade. I have lived in, I lived in Ukraine for 5 years. I lived in Tunisia for 3 years, and I lived there when Israel, when the genocide began. And I now live in Romania. And I have never once thought to be dishonest about who I am or where I'm from or the passport I hold. I mean, it is certainly a topic of conversation that has come up between, you know, myself and my other friends who are expatriates in the countries I live in. But it's also been a topic between me and the people at my co-working space and in yoga class and things like this, because people are curious. I've not encountered anybody who's been explicitly angry at me. And I think people are more, they're curious. They don't understand what's going on. I don't understand fully either, but I'm happy to answer as many questions as I can, just as I'm curious about other people's culture and, you know, my identity as a U.S. citizen. And the way that I move through the world with that is the same way that I would move through the world with any of my identities. I am a woman, so I would be very mindful about entering into spaces where it might be unsafe for me as a woman to be. I would be treating my identity as a U.S. citizen the same way. If there was a place where I thought that it would put me in danger, I would not go into those places. So for me, it's not about hiding who I am or what my identity maybe represents to other people, but using that as a gateway for conversation and being mindful about what that identity might do or be as a result of the places I'm in.
And it just goes deeper, since we're just talking about identity abroad, as in particular as an American. I remember, I feel like this was 2018 or 17, and I was in Norway for the Peace Prize ceremonies. And a friend that I met there, we were just sitting and people watching. And she said, I could tell Americans. And so she was like, I can tell Americans among the crowd. But I remember for the first time just realizing that when I'm abroad, people just see me as an American. And for listeners, I'm a Black American. And in my own country, there's always been kind of like a separation. And I grew up in Los Angeles, so I grew up with a lot of different versions of Americans. I had a lot of Asian American friends and white American friends, which we don't walk around saying white American. We just say, but we do distinguish everybody else's ethnicity / hyphen American, right? But abroad, I'm just seen as American. And even when I lived in Mexico, I was just American. And so that was a big identity distinction that I did and still do feel. But back to the Norway people watching situation, it was quite hilarious at that time because she said, oh, well, first of all, she was like, when we're seeing people, groups of people together, she was like, well, that group over there, you really generally, there's an Indian person, there's two white people, and then there's a Black person, and you could tell they're all together, and that's not how the rest of the world is kind of set up. She said that was one identifier. She said this in her particular way, and maybe was lost in translation, but she's like, you guys are a mixed breed, Americans. But then also she distinguished at that time our shoes, we wear sneakers with everywhere and everything. And now I see, because I spend so much time in France, that has infiltrated everywhere. A lot of people just wear sneakers or trainers. I remember asking though, like, well, what do you wear? And she was like, shoes. We wear shoes. We wear shoes and we use sneakers or the trainers for working out or if we're going to take a run. So yeah, identity when you're abroad kind of really does stand out. But feeling like a representative, I don't feel like I need to, you know, move differently. It's so that I can, you know, have a better reflection on myself. I move in the same way as Joanna mentioned, as a woman and with my home training and the respect, you know, for others, but just how others view us. And then also the curiosity comes in with whatever's happening because of American soft power penetrating everywhere around the world. When people encounter an actual American, they're curious whether it's about the pop culture or a lot of it is about the pop culture, or is this really true? Or, and then, you know, of course, when we have really high political actions, they're curious about that as well.
That's so interesting. As a Canadian, that's interesting because I don't know, maybe this is like obviously an anecdotal experience, but I find a lot of the time people don't know very much about Canada or have very many questions because they don't know very much about us. But you've both touched on something that we haven't really honed in on yet, which is also that like our individual experiences as tourists are shaped by politics as well. I think about this a lot myself from a gender perspective, like traveling with my partner in some countries where there are different rights for women. I can feel that. I feel that difference in my daily experience in a country. He does not feel that. And I often think about how that like really differentiates our experience of a place. I've noticed this like in Morocco. I've traveled there alone, but I've also traveled there with a friend who was male. And the experience was completely different because of the makeup of who I was with and my identity and how it intersected with the identity of my traveling companion. And obviously, like race, gender, sexual identity, even the language that we speak factors into this. And I think that's something that people often overlook, especially if they're in a very like privileged identity space, like a white man, for example.
And the way that you experience those things, just to, you know, come full circle to what we are talking about, that is shaped by, you know, cultural norms, laws, religion, things that have happened throughout history. And that is all political.
Yeah, absolutely. So one thing that I have found is that by thinking a lot about how politics shapes travel, I find that sometimes harder questions are raised, at least for me. Something I struggle with specifically is the question of like, where do I draw the moral line when choosing whether or not to visit a place, when a country's government is engaged in policies that I disagree with, for example. I often like feel stuck on how I should factor that into the decision to visit. I also wonder a lot about like whether boycotting is like a useful political act to be engaging in when it comes to tourism, like whether that is something that we should actively be doing. Where I get stuck on with boycotting is like it works better when it's done en masse. Like, I don't know if my individual boycott will have a huge impact. That was just a brain dump. I'm curious what both of you think about this.
That is a very complicated one for me as well. And I often get asked that because I talk a lot about kind of ethical and responsible travel practices. And yeah, like how do we decide what is a place that we should avoid? Sometimes I think it's places where the entire infrastructure we know is built on slave labor, like Dubai, or, you know, some other places in the Middle East. It could be easier to say, well, I don't need to contribute to that infrastructure. But then also I know people who have to go there for their lifestyle, for like for work, right? Or their partner is working there. I don't have a clear-cut answer for that. I just know that a personal responsibility that I always try to take is just to whittle it down to like my own interactions. Like if I am going to take a tour, maybe the least I can do is make sure that it is locally owned and operated so that there isn't tourism leakage of the dollars that I bring to the economy. So it's not like a big third party, especially foreign company that siphons all the, you know, the money. And that is the most that I know that I can personally be responsible to. But sometimes, like I as a traveler and as a curious one as well, like I do want to have as much exposure to everyone and every place as I can. But yeah, how do you restrict it to places where, like, and I know people have different approaches to, like, there's places where it is forbidden or restricted to go to, like a North Korea. But if there was an opportunity to go, and even if it was under just like extreme surveillance and, you know, they don't want you to say any of your own real thoughts while you're there, would I reject that? Or would I take the opportunity to go to some place that mostly nobody else gets to have access to, versus a place where we know that is not treating not only citizens, you know, properly, but also just labor is not respected or treated. And it is kind of like slave conditions where they've taken their own passports and the people are stuck there and having to work. And then they will be working directly interfacing with you because you're staying at a particular hotel or going to a restaurant. I don't have a clean cut answer for that, but just a personal responsibility move. That's just kind of what I rely on.
I have personal feelings about certain places in the world, and that's based on the way people are treated, the current politics in those places in some instances. And I'll name it right out. Antarctica, I believe from, a climate perspective, I don't believe that it's responsible for people to be traveling there. And that's tied up with politics as well. So there are, I would say my list of places that I will not go to is not long, but generous. And I also, as time has gone on, I've actually thought more and more critically about my capacity to care for myself as a person and as a traveler in places. So I do think about things like, does my insurance cover if anything goes wrong? If something happens to me, am I a burden on the local population? Is there an embassy here to offer some support for American citizens? Are resources going to be used first on the people who live here? And am I going to be in the way? And I know that every time we travel, we take that chance, right? There are natural disasters we can't predict. People who are stuck in the Middle East right now, for example, who were there for business, can't get out of Dubai, whatever the case might be, there are always going to be things we can't predict. But we can also be mindful about what our needs would be if we were in a place. And I have, over time, gotten more cautious about choosing where I go and trying to make sure that I can rely on myself and my ability to care for myself should something go sideways, because I don't want to be a burden on the people who live in a place. Yeah, I do have political feelings about some places. There are places I would choose not to travel to, but I think that's a much wider scope than most people, because I would be self-selecting not to go places that maybe aren't considered dangerous or, not okay to travel to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel similarly. Like, it's definitely a mixture for me. Like, some of it is political and I guess like moral, but there's other ones that it's just like a personal safety question where I'm not sure I feel comfortable. I'm not sure, like you said, the resources are there. I think a lot about like my family, like, will my dad be anxious for 2 weeks straight if I go to this country? These are things that I think about that, to be honest, I didn't think about when I was younger. And so I think you're right to point out that it is a very personal decision. And you're seeing that play out like here in Canada right now. Like, obviously the Canada-US example is such a current one to go back to, but like there are Canadians that feel very strongly against going to the US right now. And there are Canadians who do not care and are just actively going on their vacations. And I think that really points to how it like really is a personal decision when it comes down to it, which is probably impacted in part by your identity and the like personal risks that would come with traveling to a specific place at a specific moment.
And I would say even in the United States, you probably have people who are uncomfortable traveling to other states. That's the other thing to be mindful of, is when we hear something like, oh, this thing is happening in this country, especially for countries that are very big. You can't just, pin what's happening in, with ICE in Minneapolis on the entire United States. For big countries, it is important to be mindful about the fact that, what's happening in one city or one state or one region, province, whatever the case might be, that might not be impacting other places. And I know, for example, Jordan really, their tourism was really impacted with what is happening between Israel and Palestine. And Jordan is safe to go to, separate from that conflict. So yeah, I mean, there's no clear-cut answer, but I do think that it is important that people at least are thinking about these things as they're making their travel decisions.
So I thought it would be helpful to wrap up by talking about a recent real-world example that really illustrates how travel and politics do intersect, sometimes in very obvious ways. So in January 2026, foreign tourists were stranded on Yemen's island of Socotra, and this was after authorities closed ports and canceled flights. The shutdown was because of rising tensions between Saudi Arabia and the UAE, which was tied to Yemen's ongoing conflict. So tourists on the island were left there. They were stuck. They had no clear way of going home. Joanna, as this was happening, you made a post on Threads where you pointed out that many influencers have traveled to Socotra recently, and a shocking number of them either don't realize the political turmoil that's been happening, or they don't even realize that they're in Yemen. They think of it as like a separate country, potentially. I've really noticed this. You know, it's like in the last like 2 years that suddenly I see Socotra all over my feed. I see people saying they dream of going to Socotra, and it happened very quickly. So you raised some questions in your post that I would love to unpack. To start, when tensions are escalating in a place like Socotra, how do you think travelers should think about responsibility in their decision to go?
I know that, a content creator, an influencer is, trying to put the best face on a place. They're often hired by these places to promote these destinations. But I do feel that ideally people are doing their own research and they know that they're going to Yemen. But the truth is that you can catch flights to Socotra that don't even go through the mainland. They go straight to the island. And so I agree with you. People don't even know that. And it's true of a lot of destinations. People are not aware of the bigger picture. And so even though we can be hopeful that people are doing their research and checking the news and reading a little bit more about, what the historical context is and looking at the, the reports that embassies put out about whether you should travel or not. And of course, that take all of that with a grain of salt always. But because we know people are not doing that, I think personally that if you are an influencer, if you are a content creator who's using their platform to encourage people to go to these places, I think there is a responsibility to at least disclose that people should do some more research, that they should look into the situation themselves. You can talk about all the beautiful things and put a beautiful face on it, but toss a little footnote in there, or mention it on your reel that travelers to this destination should do their research before they go. I don't know of any cases where content creators or influencers have been held responsible for encouraging people to go somewhere where there has then been a problem. And maybe Aaron or Davey, you are aware of something like this, but even if they are not being held responsible, I think that as somebody with a platform, as somebody who knows they have influence over people's decisions, they can use that influence to encourage a little deeper insight as people are making their travel plans.
I totally agree. And something I've thought about as someone who does work with tourism boards and DMOs is about what responsibility they have on their end to give you instruction around how to talk about it. So like, for example, I've looked at working with Ireland and potentially going to Northern Ireland. And one of the questions I had for them was, how do you want me to frame Northern Ireland? A lot of, especially Canadians, like don't know about the political history there. And in my mind, they should have like verbiage on this, like something they send you that explains like, this is how you should talk about this when you present this on your platforms.
This is exactly what I wanted to talk about too, just like flipping it on the reverse side is not just the content creators, but the tourism boards. I feel like there's a denial of what's happening geopolitically with them across the world. And I know it's their job to show the shiny, bright light and the beautiful parts of the destination. And I know they are a direct arm of the government, right? So there's the politics colliding as well. But it is a disservice to the traveler to not tell them what is happening in the background. And even if it is just like the last paragraph of the brochure, it is important because it's part of the history or what is ongoing, right? And they can use diplomatic speech to present it. But I think it is a responsibility to not be in la la land and pretend that these things don't go on. And that's kind of my biggest frustration, is not so much with the content creators, because we understand they are another extension of the marketing arm of that. And if they're a content creator who is not a journalist, then they just don't have the skill set, or quite frankly, like, they're commercial, so they don't even have necessarily the responsibility, unless it's their own personal responsibility, to disclose to their audience, right? They're just an extension of that whole system. And it doesn't mean that I agree with, you know, moving in that way. It's just that I just understand that how it's working for them. But I do feel frustration with tourism boards, and I've called them out before earlier this year, just saying like, you guys are in denial of what's happening and it is not fair. There's going to be a collide where you invite somebody to your wildlife tour, but then they, you know, what's happening on the ground, they have a direct interaction with it and you didn't prepare them and they're clueless.
And to just like continue on your point about influencers, like, having experience like that side of things as well, you are given deliverables. You are sharing metrics when you work with a DMO or a tourism board. So when I think about like influencers going to Socotra, of course they want to highlight how aesthetic it is. They don't want to talk about war because that will impact their metrics. Like the amount of people that click and actually look at booking a tour to Socotra will be impacted if they talk about the reasons why you might not want to go to Socotra. So I do kind of understand why they would present it in the way they do. I don't agree with it still, but I understand why that ends up happening. It could be that they're literally instructed not to talk about politics. Like, I could see that happening.
And me personally, because I also work with tourism boards, I reject that. And I always think it's just better to tell the truth. And there's a way to tell the truth and still inspire somebody to go. Because when you go and you have this foundation of knowing what really happens, then I think you're more impacted as a traveler to like knowing like, oh, I'm actually walking on sacred ground, or like this means so much more because I have a direct interaction with something like living history, or a direct descendant of something. So I don't agree with kind of like taking the money and giving deliverables. But again, I do understand why some people do it. They just don't have that much experience.
I'm curious to know if you feel that anything changes when we actively acknowledge that travel is political.
I think that it's so important to acknowledge that all of the choices that we make matter. They have ripple effects. Where we choose to travel, how we move through spaces, who we interact with, where we spend money. Travel doesn't exist in a silo. Travel is very much integrated and woven into the societal fabric of the places that we visit. We are all humans moving around this world, and our presence matters. So the question is, how are we going to make that presence matter in a meaningful way? And I alluded to this earlier, but I really hope that this is an invitation to, you know, not just turn a blind eye to politics, but really to be more thoughtful and aware of the decisions that we make, both when we travel and in our daily lives.
I do think it does make a difference, conversations like this and the work that all of us do, Joanna, Aaron, and even you, Katie, the more that we just keep talking about it, really does make a difference. Because even on my social media, when I talk about it, I get people telling me that, oh, shoot, you did that story about the locals not getting water in Cabo. And I had this trip going to Cabo and I felt guilty. They're aware of it now. And maybe next time they'll just be more aware and try to even do more research. So I think it is making a difference, and it does matter one person at a time. And sometimes when we are doing our work, we're passionately sharing something that matters to us and we hope people listen. And the reward is when you get feedback that it is making a difference, even if it's just awareness.
For sure. And to build on something you said earlier, Davey, this is something I think about a lot, is like, I think being informed actually does enrich your experience. Like, I see places differently when I'm informed about them. It gives me context for what I'm experiencing and what I'm observing. And I actually think that is like one of the most beautiful parts of travel. It's not just about going and aesthetically enjoying a place. Like, when you understand it from a more political and cultural and social perspective, I just find you walk away with more takeaways, more in-depth thoughts about the place. Like, it changes your worldview. And I think that's one of the most valuable parts of travel.
It's my favorite part.
Where can people find you if they want to engage with your work?
I'm at Davey Sutton on all social media, DAYVEESUTTON.
And you can find my work at Rooted Storytelling on Instagram and also online at rootedstorytelling.com.
Thanks for listening to Curious Tourism. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to share it with a fellow traveler. If you're feeling extra generous, you can leave us a 5-star review or support us on Patreon. Anything you can do to support the show will help foster meaningful change throughout the travel industry. Curious Tourism is written and hosted by me, Erin Hines, and it's produced and edited by Katie Lohr in Canada's Toronto area. If you want to reach out to us, check the show notes for all the info you need. Stay tuned for a new episode next month, and of course, stay curious.
Travel doesn't always go to plan, and that's where the best stories live. Welcome to the Winging It Travel Podcast, where you don't just hear about travel, you feel it. I'm James Hammond, and I'm podcasting my own journeys from the road, sharing immersive soundscape episodes that drop you right into the moment, from busy streets to remote mountains. Along the way, I sit down with local people and fellow travelers to tell honest stories about life, culture, and chase an adventure beyond the routine. No filters, no fake perfection, just stories to tell, tips to share, and experiences to inspire. Search Winging It Travel Podcast on any podcast app and let's wing it.
Hi, I'm Mike Siegel, and man, oh man, do I love talking about travel. You think I'd get enough of it, touring the world as a stand-up comedian, or just going off on my own personal adventures around the world? No, when I get home, I still have to talk about it. That's how much I love travel. So every week I sit down with a friend, a travel expert, influencer, expat, or anyone from any walk of life who shares my passion for travel. So if you want to hear a fun, casual, off-the-cuff chat about travel from people who love it, listen to the Travel Tales podcast with me, Mike Siegel, wherever you get your podcasts.